Thank you. Wow. I love this church. 229 years ago, our founding fathers gave us a national birth certificate in the Declaration of Independence. Over the span of time, 229 years since that point, we have become the longest running constitutional republic in the history of the world. And as you look back on those years and through our history books, and then you look at all the other countries and nations and peoples over the world, you have to say that we're blessed people. We truly are blessed to be a part of a nation such as this. And when you look at other people groups and other nations, I don't think that you can say that it's an accident that all of these things happen. But it's through the providential hand of a divine God that we're able to live in a country with the freedoms and the liberties that we have, like we do here. July 4th weekend gives us an opportunity to kind of look back on that and thank God for His blessings in those respects. In the year 1776, on July the 2nd, the members of the Congress got together and voted to completely separate from the country of Great Britain. 2 days later, on July the 4th, 1776, the first draft of the Declaration of Independence was finished, and two men signed it that day, the President of Congress, John Hancock, and Charles Thompson, who was also the Secretary of Congress. They both signed it on that day. 4 days later, on July the 8th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was taken out by the members of Congress onto the steps of Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and was read aloud to anyone who was in listening distance. People started to gather as they heard for the first time the words of the Declaration of Independence read from that original document. At the end of the Declaration of Independence, at the end of their reading it, the Liberty Bell started to ring. I wasn't an English major, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. You might not know this, but on the Liberty Bell there's an inscription from Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10. And I want us to put that up on the screens and read it. And what it says is, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." And I'm not sure that there's really a better verse that kind of describes what, I guess, maybe the American spirit or the mission of our country is than this verse. "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." And if there's one thing I think that our country and our founding fathers and the people who have fought for us have tried to do throughout the years, it's to proclaim liberty across the world and what freedom looks like. Sometimes that's been easy to do, and other times it's been really difficult. Sometimes it's led to war and conflict outside with other countries. And other times it's led to war and conflict, even in our own country, among our own ideologies. The Civil War, for instance. And I'm reflecting on this weekend and this message. One of my favorite pieces of history is the Gettysburg Address. And I want us to just take a few moments and experience anew, under those guidelines and under that history lesson, what the Gettysburg Address might have meant to the men who heard it that day. How many of you have ever been to Washington, D.C.? Oh, wow, a good number of you. If you haven't ever been to Washington, D.C., I'm telling you, you got to go at some point in life. That footage that you saw just kind of seems to come alive there. I mean, when you're in Washington, D.C., at least when I was back a couple of years ago, it just, you kind of experience it a little bit. It gets in your veins, that loyalty to country and a little bit of a feeling of what the sacrifice must have been like for the people who have fought for our freedom and the freedom of other nations, and what devotion really has to look like, at least from a patriotic standpoint. You just kind of feel it when you're there. I had the opportunity to go to D.C. in 2000. It was kind of a whirlwind trip, 36 hours in D.C. And in fact, I brought along a slideshow to show you. I'm the good-looking guy on the left. Just kidding. In the background is the Washington Monument, and it was under reconstruction at that point. When you're looking up at the Washington Monument, I mean, the thing is huge. It's the tallest thing on the skyline there. There's nothing else there that's nearly as tall as it is. And you kind of get a feel for what it must have been like to be around George Washington, you know, a tall man who, you know, is of great stature and someone who is a leader and a founder. And that landmark, it's kind of a pretty good representation of him. Then got the opportunity to go to the White House, and it's kind of a lot smaller than you think of it once you actually see it in person. But standing there outside those gates, thinking that every single president, except for one, George Washington, has lived there, and the executive branch of the government has existed in that building for all of these years, it's a little mind-boggling. And then taking that walk up towards Capitol Hill, and I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing in this picture, but it is what it is. And that building, just walking through those marbled hallways and those floors and thinking that all of our legislation happens within this building and has happened in here for literally for centuries, it kind of blew my mind. And then going on from there, we walked back down the mall to the Lincoln Memorial and the reflecting pool there. For those of you who haven't been in D.C., the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial is right over there to the right. You can't really see it, but you know, I didn't have the opportunity to grow up during the Vietnam War era. Most of my parents' generation and y'all will remember what that was like. So I really don't have any frame of reference for what that was like. But seeing the Vietnam War Memorial and seeing all of those names, just literally hundreds of thousands of names etched into that black granite is just, I don't know what it was like, but you kind of get an emotion or a feeling when you look at that of what that sacrifice must have been like. And that's kind of what a good landmark does. Is a landmark or a memorial, it kind of evokes an emotion. It brings something up on the inside of you, whether you were a part of that or not. That's what landmarks are there for, to remind you of what happened and to kind of monument to that event. That's what it's there for. And then the last picture is just inside the Lincoln Memorial there, which is probably one of my favorite places in D.C. just because I'm a huge fan of Abraham Lincoln. So there, that's my slideshow. But, you know, landmarks are there. Some of them are there for events, for big events that took place, like the Vietnam War Memorial. Others are there for people, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln. Others are there for ideologies, or, you know, whether it's freedom or liberty, like the Liberty Bell, it represents liberty to us. And when you're looking at some of those landmarks and things, like I said, you just kind of get a feel for loyalty to the country. You kind of get an emotional response of what it must have been like for that sacrifice to take place from those people. And it does create in you some devotion. It kind of creates a little bit of allegiance to America when you see those things and when you experience those things. And that's what they're there for. And this morning, what I want us to do is I want us to take a look back at another nation, another country, who kind of experienced in some respects the same thing that we do here. In the Old Testament, where we're going to look this morning, we're going to kind of talk through a little bit the nation of Israel, the Jewish nation, God's chosen people. And if there's a country or a nation or a group of people that I think is a good reflection of who we are and a good kind of representation or parallel to who we are, it would be that nation, that country. You know, they were God's chosen people. They were spiritual people. They worshiped God. And God told them to go to Egypt. And for those of you who might not know the story, you might have seen the Ten Commandments or the Prince of Egypt. And the story goes, when they were in Egypt, everything was okay for a while, but then it got bad. Eventually, oppression came on the Jewish people and on the Israelite nation as a new Pharaoh came up and he put the Israelite people into bondage. He put them into slavery and said, you know, I'm taking away your freedom because we need blue-collar labor here. And so for years, the Israelites worked under that bondage and under that oppression, hoping for freedom, praying for liberty, hoping that at some point God would release them from their burden, would release them from the bondage. And they knew that they were God's chosen people, but they couldn't understand why they were going through all of this. Moses grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth. Moses grew up with Pharaoh, grew up in the high society of Egypt, but he was an Israelite. He eventually came to a point in his life where he had a decision to make. He could either live a nice, comfortable life, or he could, quote unquote, throw all of that away to try and liberate his people. He could turn his back on all of the comforts and all the freedom that he had known and that he experienced so that his country, so that his nation could have freedom, could have liberty. And through a series of events, that's basically what he did. He went to Pharaoh and he said, on behalf of God, let my people go. On behalf of God, let us go and have our own freedom. Let us go and have our own ability to worship as we want. Let us have liberty. Please, let us go. Pharaoh said no. And so what happened basically was a civil war in the midst of Egypt as the white-collar Egyptians and the blue-collar labor who was under bondage and oppression duked it out. Fortunately, God was on the side of the Israelites, and eventually after the 10 plagues and all, Pharaoh finally had enough and said, all right, get out of here. I don't want to see y'all again. I don't want to see your God again. Get lost. Have your liberty. Have your freedom. As long as it doesn't interfere with my life, just leave. And that's what they did. They left. They finally had their freedom. They finally had their liberty. But they forgot. They forgot God. They turned their back on God, and they basically rebelled. They said, you know what, we don't really need to keep God as the front burner in our lives. We don't really need to pay attention to Him. We've got our freedom, we've got our liberty, you know, all of that Egyptian stuff is behind us. There's nothing we need to worry about anymore. You know, we're headed to a new place, to a new area, a land that God has said He will use to bless us. The promised land is what they called it. And they said, okay, well, we're headed there. We don't really need to pay attention to God anymore. It didn't work out too well for him. For those of you who know the story, a trip that should have taken just maybe a few days or a few weeks to get across the Sinai desert took 40 years. 40 years they wandered in the desert. God held them in a holding pattern in the desert, just traveling there until they were ready to move on. Until their hearts have been changed. In fact, every single person except two out of all the tens of hundreds of thousands of people who had left Egypt died. Only two people out of tens of hundreds of thousands of those ever saw the blessing because they forgot what God had done for them in Egypt and turned their backs on Him. And so after 40 years, a new leader, Joshua, finally comes along and replaces Moses. And God says, okay, it's time. And that's where we're going to pick up the story this morning in Joshua chapter 1, verse 2. Now that my servant Moses is dead, this is God speaking to Joshua, now that my servant Moses is dead, you must lead my people across the Jordan River into the land I'm giving them. I promise you what I promised Moses. Everywhere you go, Joshua, you'll be on land I've given you. No one will be able to stand their ground against you as long as I live, for I'll be with you as I was with Moses, and I will not fail you or abandon you. Be strong and courageous, for you will lead my people to possess all the land I swore to give their ancestors. Verse 7, be strong, he says again, and very courageous. Obey all the laws Moses gave you. Do not turn away from them, and you'll be successful in everything you do. Study this book of the law continually. Meditate on it day and night so you may be sure to obey all that's written in it. Only then will you succeed. Verse 9, I command you, be strong and courageous, he says a third time. Don't be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. God raises up a new leader, and he says, it's time. I know that I have promised you the blessing. I know that I've promised to bless you with this new land and with this new place that you can call your home. Liberty is just on the other side of the Jordan River. Freedom is just on the other side of the Jordan River. And it's finally time to go. It's finally time to be there. So Joshua started making preparation for all of this to come. And he told all the people who were there, pack up all your tents. Get any of your food or any of your belongings together. Get with your families. Within 3 days, we're going to pack up camp and we're going to move into the promised blessing. We're going to move into the land that lay on the other side of the Jordan River. We're finally, after 40 years, going to experience what our parents hoped for. What those people who came before us, our forefathers, could only dream of. We're going to get to experience the blessing of. In Joshua chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, Joshua tells the people, purify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do great wonders among you. In the morning, Joshua said to the priests, now lift up the ark and lead the people across the river. And so they started out. Joshua was telling the people in this verse and in the verses surrounding it that the living God was among them. The God whom their parents had prayed to, the God of Abraham and Isaac, the God of Adam and Eve was among them. He was here with them and he had their backs. And he was saying to them that he will without fail drive your enemies away. Anyone who stands up against you as you move into the things that I've promised to you, I'm going to wipe them out for you. You're not going to have to worry about that. As long as you keep a direct relationship with me, as long as you keep me in the front burner of your lives, I will make every enemy fall against you. This was his promise to them. And that was all they needed. So they picked up the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant led the way, and then the priests followed after that, and all the tens of thousands of Israelites started towards the Jordan River. Now, they had absolutely no idea what was going to happen when they got there. The Jordan River was this huge river, and at this point of year, it was flooded over its banks because it was harvest time. And they didn't know how they were going to get across when they got there. You don't really need boats and things in the desert, so they really had no way to get across the Jordan River. But they just believed God. They said, okay, if God said it, then we're just going to believe it and move on and trust that he's going to take care of it. Only two out of the tens of thousands of people had seen what happened at the Red Sea when they left Egypt. So now when we come in chapter 3, verse 14, he says, when the people set out to cross the Jordan, the priests who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them first. Verse 15, now it was harvest season, and the Jordan was overflowing its banks. But as soon as the feet of the priests who were carrying the Ark touched the water at the river's edge, the water began piling up at a town upstream called Adam, which is near Zarethan. And the water below flowed on into the Dead Sea until the riverbed was dry. And then all the people crossed over near the city of Jericho. Verse 17, meanwhile, the priests who were carrying the ark of the Lord's covenant stood on dry ground in the middle of the riverbed as the people passed by them. And they waited there until everyone had crossed the Jordan on dry ground. So all these people are just walking towards the Jordan River, and they have absolutely no idea what's going to happen when they get there, but God does. And they get there, and the priests step up, and the people who put their feet right into the water holding the Ark of the Covenant on their poles, the water just stops. It just stops flowing. Several miles up the river, God has dammed up the water, and then what's left in the riverbed flows on through. And just to kind of prove his point, God dries out the riverbed beneath them. All that happens immediately, as soon as those priests step into the water with the Ark of the Covenant. And so they continue on trotting on the Jordan riverbed into the middle of the Jordan River, and they stand there with the Ark of the Covenant as multitudes, as thousands, tens of thousands of people pass them by, walking on dry ground in the middle of a river, to the other side, to the land that God had promised them, to where the blessing lay, to where God was sending them, to the hopes and dreams of their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. It must have been an amazing day. It must have been a phenomenal day to see God do something like that, to experience right then and there God do something miraculous, something amazing, something monumental. Can't imagine what it would have been like to be there that day. Joshua chapter 4, verse 1, it picks up and says, when all the people were safely across the river, the Lord said to Joshua, now choose 12 men one from each tribe, and tell the men to take 12 stones from where the priests are standing in the middle of the Jordan, and then pile them up at the place where you camp tonight. Now, I've got one stone right here, and the stones which they picked up were probably larger, but not so large that one person couldn't carry them. And so Joshua says, I want 12 men, one representing each one of the people groups who are with the Israelites. When you're in the middle of the dry riverbed, I want you to pick up a stone off the bottom of the river, right there where the ark is at, and I want you to carry it with you until we camp tonight. And so I can imagine, you know, the people are thinking, okay, you know, are we going to use these to put around a bonfire? You know, is he going to set up Stonehenge? I mean, you know, what's going to happen here? Here's what happened. Joshua chapter 4 verse 19 says, the people crossed the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, the month that marked their exodus from Egypt, and they camped at Gilgal, east of Jericho, and it was there at Gilgal that Joshua piled up the 12 stones taken from the Jordan River. So I had the 12 men take the stones. Now, I have passed out 12 stones to 12 men in the audience. If you guys don't mind, just get up out of your seat and head on up here. And what they did was when they got to their place of camp that night, they took the stones which they had picked up from the Jordan River, and they piled them up. And we're not exactly sure how they did it. They might have thrown them on top of each other. They might have made some sort of a design out of them. We're not really sure what the size of the stones were or, you know, exactly how they looked. But what we do know is there were 12 stones carried by 12 men, and they piled them up when they got to the place where they stayed that night. That was the first night that they had spent in the Promised Land. That was the first night that they had spent literally, physically, in the place that God had been telling them of, that their forefathers had been telling them about for years, possibly even for centuries. The first night that they stayed in the place that was their blessing, that was their inheritance, that was what God had intended to give them. Their first place where they truly probably felt liberty, where they truly probably felt freedom. That night, that place, they piled up 12 stones. Anyone know why?
12 tribes of Israel.
12 tribes of Israel? Good. Anyone know why the 12 tribes of Israel, why they put those stones there like that? Anyone want to hazard a guess? As a landmark, as a marker, as a monument? Yeah. They put the stones there as a visual reminder of what God had done that day. God knew, and Joshua knew, that it was a good idea to help the people remember what had happened. And the best way to help the people remember what had happened is not just to tell stories about it, but to set up something visual, to give them something to look at, to say, oh yeah, there, that's what that is. Those were all piled up the day that our ancestors, that our parents, crossed across the Jordan riverbed on dry ground. It was there for remembrance, to kind of jog the memory. In fact, Joshua chapter 4 verse 21 kind of clears it up for us a little more when it says, then Joshua said to the Israelites, in the future, your children are going to ask, what do these stones mean? Then you can tell them that this is where the Israelites crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the river right before your eyes, and he kept it dry until you were all across, just as he did at the Red Sea, when he dried it up until we had all crossed over. Verse 24, and he did this so that all the nations of the earth might know the power of the Lord, and that you might fear the Lord your God forever. I'll say that again, verse 24. He did this so that all the nations of the earth might know the power of the Lord, and that you might fear the Lord your God forever. It was a landmark. It was something to help them remember where God broke through time and space and performed a miracle in their lives. And you see, that's really what a remembrance in the Bible or what a monument or a memorial in the Old Testament is. It's basically a point where God reaches down and does something spectacular in the life of his people, like what happened on that day. You know, the people who had children who were there that day, the children might not have experienced what happened. But you know what? When kids would walk by and would say, you know, Mom, Dad, what in the world is that pile of stones there for? They could say, you know why that pile of stones is there for? And then they could tell the story about what happened when God reached down in time and space and performed a miraculous thing in their midst. You see, God knew and Joshua knew that sometimes we just need visual reminders. Sometimes we just kind of need to put shoe leather to our faith. Sometimes we just kind of need something visual, something concrete to help us deal with something that's in the past or so abstract or so historical. That's why the stones are there. In fact, in Joshua chapter 4, verse 7, backing up a little bit, Joshua says, "They remind us that the Jordan River stopped flowing when the Ark of the Lord's Covenant went across." And this is an important part. "These stones will stand as a permanent memorial among the people of Israel." And this isn't, in fact, the only time that the people of Israel or that Joshua did this. At least 8 other times in the book of Joshua alone, when something happens, a great battle that they win, or something amazing happens in their midst, and there's no other explanation for it than God, they'll go and pick up 12 stones and pile them up and create a monument or an altar or something out of it. And you got to figure, you know, at some point, you know, you just kind of get used to it. Okay, we won this battle. All right, Joshua, 12 stones, right? Okay, you know, they got to think that they probably started thinking, okay, this is what we're going to do. And they did, at least 8 times. And a couple of those times, they even did it when they lost the battle. They even set a monument or an altar up in those occasions where they didn't pay attention to God or they did something wrong and they lost the battle because of their own rebellion or because of their own abuse of God's law. And so they didn't just set them up for good things, but occasionally they would set them up for bad things. Why? Again, it's a reminder, it's a landmark that, you know, we did something wrong here. Something went bad. And so to remind us to never do that again, to never turn our back on God again, to never rebel again, let's sit up these stones here and create a monument here to remind us if you do it again, you're probably going to get the same results again. And so they use these visual monuments, these visual landmarkers to tell the story of their faith to their children, but more than that, as a reminder to themselves and the future generations that God did exist. That God was a God who did what He said He was going to do. And these are the points and the places and the times where He did it, where He followed through. Do you have any landmarks in your life? Do you have any places in your life where you can look back to and say, I can point to that time and that place as a point where God reached down from heaven and did something amazing, something miraculous, something transforming in my midst? I can point back to a time in my life or to my history where God reached down through time and space and took hold of me and did something amazing inside of my life. Do you have any points of time like that in your life? Any landmarks? Any memorials? Any things that are worth remembering between you and God? Boy, I hope so. For those of us who are Christ followers, we have at least one. We have the time where we decided to turn our back on the old life, to turn our back on sin, and to face towards God and to reach up and grab that hand out of heaven and say, God, no matter what happens to me in life, the good or the bad, the success or the failure, the trial, the trouble, the tribulation, no matter what, I'm going to hold on to Your hand and You're going to hold on to my hand. That's a landmark experience in our life. Maybe there's some other point in life where God has, maybe it's financially, or maybe it's healing, or maybe it's a miracle in your midst, maybe a job situation. What are they for you? What are the landmarks spiritually where God reached down and did something amazing in your midst? Don't forget them. In fact, do everything that you can to not forget those times in your life. Write them down. Paint pictures. Get them on videotape. I don't care what you do to remember them, but get something concrete. Not just for you. Not just to something that you can remember, but like Joshua, like something your children can remember. You see, Joshua knew that the faith of the people who crossed the Jordan River was to be lost one generation away if that next generation didn't know what happened to the first generation. Joshua knew that if we don't transfer those stories to our children, they're never going to know about God's work in our lives and in our midst. Joshua knew that. Are you passing on your landmarks to your children? Can your parents, can your children tell your salvation experience? Do they know that? Can your children point to times in your life where God has moved? Do they know those things? Why don't they? Our families need to see our landmarks. Our families need to celebrate with us the times where God has reached down and done something in our midst. Verse 24, we read a couple of times here, says that the Israelites set up that so that all the nations of the earth might know the power of the Lord, and so that you might fear the Lord your God forever. You know, it's not just for our families, but it's for our neighbors, it's for our co-workers, it's for our friends. You know, if God has done something in your midst, other people need to know about it. You need to be celebrating those things so that other people who might not even be in your family see that God is a God who does what He says He's going to do, a God who blesses, a God who follows through on promises, a God who takes care of you in tough times as well as during the good times. If we don't set up landmarks, we're in danger of losing our faith and wandering in a desert for 40 years. Close with this. I believe that all of us here today fit into one of three categories. One of three different types of people. A lot of us who are in this room are what I'm going to call this first chair, a first chair believer. The people who sit in this chair are like the Israelites. They have seen God work in their midst. These are the committed Christians. These are the people who are following Christ, and no matter what comes up against them, they're just going to keep going along. These are the people who have seen, not once, but probably over and over and over again, God make those landmarks. God do those things to remember in their lives. These are the people that really have a genuine relationship with Christ. They'll go to their grave with their faith. And in their obituary, you'll be able to tell that they lived for God, lived for Christ, and lived with all of their heart. There are a lot of us who are sitting in this chair. Some of us, though, are in the second chair. These are the children of the people who sit in this chair. A lot of us have parents who are that type of person. A lot of us have people in our lives and in our history or around us who are first chair, who they got it all together. God seems to work for them, and it doesn't matter what they do wrong, it just always seems to happen and take care of itself. The blessing of God is on these people, and it happens seemingly all the time. But these people really don't experience. These people are the people who have maybe grown up in church, they've grown up in families where they've been committed, dedicated Christians. But these people, it just didn't seem to work this way for them. And maybe there are some of you out here who are thinking, you know what, that's me. You know, I had a parent or a grandparent or someone who everything seemed to have it together with God. But me, it just doesn't seem to work the same way for me. Some of us are sitting in this chair. We know God here, but we don't really know Him here. It's never really affected us. It's never really made sense. These people have children who sit in the third chair. These people have probably never been in church, or if so, only a few times in their life. They know that there are people who worship God, there are people who go to church, there are people who kind of do these things, but they're not one but two generations removed from seeing anyone who it's ever affected. You know, they know that there are people out there on TV who, you know, apparently God seems to work in their lives, or they hear stories, but they don't really have any personal connection with anyone who ever has had God work in their midst. You know, we are only two generations in danger of our family sitting in this chair. Which chair are you in this morning? Are you in the first chair? where God has done amazing things in your life. Or maybe you're in the second chair where you know God exists, but you've never really seen Him work. Or maybe you're in the third chair where none of it makes sense to you. And I say this morning that no matter where you're at for you, this is a church that cares about where you're at. A year ago, I came to Mountaintop for the first time, just kind of as a visitor passing through to Indiana. And I fell in love with this place. I fell in love with this church and with the people here and the mission. And as I drove away, I said, I can't explain it, but I got to be a part of it. And no matter where you're at in any of these three chairs, I can promise you that this is a church that cares about you no matter where you're at. And I say to all of us, if you're in the first chair, be telling your children about the landmarks in your life. Be telling your families and your neighbors and your friends around you about the times where God has done it. The times where God has reached down and changed things for you. Tell those stories all the time. If you don't tell those stories, you live in danger of having children who sit in seat number two. And if you're here this morning in seat number two, your life can change. It really can. God is reaching down His hand to you and saying, all I need you to do is reach up and grab it. All I want you to do is just have faith that I'm going to be the same God to you that I was to the Israelites. I'm going to be the same God to you as I was to the God who they crossed the Jordan River to get to the promised land. I will be that same God. Just believe in who I am and confess that you want me as much as I want you. That you need me as much as I need you. If you're in the third chair, hang on. Hang around. Don't give up. On the back of your program, there are a ton of activities and things listed in that you can be a part of. If you want to stick around and see, is this church thing really real? Does God really do these things? Is the Bible really true? You don't have to sit in this chair. You hang around here for a few weeks and you can see it firsthand in the people around you. Or this morning you can make the same change that these people did. You can make the same change by reaching up and grabbing God's hand and saying, I don't want to be in this chair any longer. I want to sit in this chair. It's as easy as that. And this morning, I pray that all of us will make a commitment to identify the monuments, the landmarks that are in our own lives. Commit to remembering them. Commit to writing them down. Commit to telling other people, especially our families around them, to keep from having people, especially people who we care about, in this third chair, in this second chair. What a better way to celebrate this weekend than to talk about national landmarks and spiritual landmarks and help our kids understand the significance of both of those.